Many of you might have heard about 3 months ago a paper was released and it was popularly described by the media. All sorts of crazy things. But essentially what they said was that a couple of scientists had come together and they had found new information that, if you like, said atolls were not as vulnerable to sea level rise as we formerly thought. And in fact, some papers said that atolls were growing vertically. Now, the interesting thing is, I was one of the authors of that paper, and we didn't say anything about atolls not being vulnerable, and we didn't say anything about atolls growing vertically. Absolutely didn't say that stuff. But the media really got this very confused. So I thought it'd be really nice to explain to you some of the science and some of the ongoing work behind that paper. And again, answer questions if you happen to have seen that issue and had questions about it. I usually put this picture in because it says everything that needs to be said about atolls and sea level. The height of this causeway is actually higher than the land that I'm standing on, and the land over here, and this is a normal high tide. So you've got less than 1 meter above normal high tide. It doesn't take genius to see what sea level means to these places, and the fact that it's an imminent threat. Okay? We're looking at rates of 3 millimeters per year, and they're accelerating. We've got real problems. Again, says it all. Normal high tide, there's somebody's house. You can see how high this place is above sea level. Okay? Other issues. So there's all of the more emotive inundation issues that we're used to discussing. However, other issues are problem flooding in low-lying areas. This is Bureau of Met office in Funafuti, Tuvalu, and they routinely get saltwater flooding in their front yard. These swamp taro gardens, which I showed you in that example of topographic data, they're very low-lying and they can be inundated with salt water. And taro will not tolerate that. Taro likes the same sort of freshness of water that you and I do for drinking. Wells. Okay, groundwater wells are consistently used throughout the atolls for water supply. And the other issue is sea level rise and shoreline instability. And that's really my research area. When I'm not busy shuffling papers as a manager, that's what I would like to do, but I spend less and less time doing it. So let's start and have a think about what we know about sea level in the region at the moment. Measured sea level from our tide gauges, and I've already explained to you, our gauges at the moment are really quite immature to be extracting rates from. But if we were to extract rates, the average rate would be around 4.8 millimetres per year. Yeah? But with all the caveats that it's really just a bit too young to be considering yet. Church et al., one of the most authoritative papers on sea level for the Central Pacific region, his best estimates come to about 100 millimetres over the last 50 years. The IPCC, in its last assessment report, estimated during the 20th century 170 millimetres, and present rates 3.1 millimetres per year. And whether we like it or not, and you know, it'd be interesting to see where the next assessment report goes with from the IPCC. All of that evidence alone, plus this whole raft of evidence out there, shows us that rates are increasing. Okay, they were lower in the past, they're higher now. We expect them to continue increasing. So we shouldn't be looking for linear rates. We're looking for a curved line. Yeah. We also don't know where the end point is. So any of these lines where you see where they stop somewhere, look at that with great caution. So we can accept there's been around 100 millimetres of sea level rise in the Pacific, so that's about that much, over the last 50 years. On that fact, there's then been, faith, that amount of sea level rise has caused a destabilising of shoreline systems, and particularly atoll shoreline systems. There's very little research. Indeed, I haven't read any paper that really explains why that should be. So I started, when I started my job, looking for why is there all this discussion of erosion, yet I can't find the research. I need the research so I know what's going on. And it seems that this model here, which is still available by the UNESCO website, is probably largely to blame for these ideas of shoreline instability. And it's called the Brun rule. And the Brun rule is a very, very simple rule which says for every incremental increase in sea level, you'll get an incremental loss of land or erosion. And there, again, this really simplistic mathematical model here, for 100 millimetres of sea level, or 0.1 metres of sea level, you should lose 100 times 100, you should lose 10 metres of shoreline. That's in other words, your island shrinks by 10 metres. That should be very easy to measure. We know we've had the sea level rise, and we should be able to see evidence of this all over the place if it's correct. Okay. The other aspect of this is that the media has treated this issue just almost with disdain. They will report all sorts of things, and it's not based on science, and it's really muddy in the waters. No one knows what to believe on these issues anymore. This is just one example. There are literally thousands out there. You can find them for yourselves. But this is quite a well-publicised example. The island of Te Puka Savilivili. This is Funafuti, about 20 kilometres long here. Within that yellow box is this tiny island. That was the island back in 1901. That was the island in 76. This is the island in 2009. And when people say islands have disappeared in the Pacific, this is usually the one they're actually talking about. There's another one in Tarawa. Now, absolutely true. It no longer has vegetation. Okay? But it had 1, 2, 3, 4 larger trees 100 years ago. And in the 70s, had 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5. Okay? This was never a massive island. It's a terrible example for anyone to use as evidence of climate change impacts. Because any storm is going to disturb this island. If we'd never heard of climate change, this would always be a vulnerable small island. It's not a good place to live. Unfortunately, examples like that being used has really skewed our understanding of what's going on these islands, and it's, in many cases it's stopped people from actually asking the right questions to find out what's going on. Oh, and that's just another inset there. So that's that yellow dot. You can see how small this island is. It sits right within that circle. It's tiny. So to try and bring some, I guess, empirical understanding to these questions, we started monitoring a whole load of different atolls across a very large geographic range from the North Pacific through the Equatorial Pacific down into Tuvalu. And, you know, if we had the resources, we'd keep going and make it bigger. And the methods we used were around these remote sensing methods. So we became aware there was all sorts of historical photographs laying around in various offices and holding doors open and all sorts of things, rats living in them. And we started bringing these all back to the Secretariat, scanning them, and then returning them back to the countries or holding them if they would like us to hold them. So we actually do have a fancier scanner than that. Our monitors are even fancier than that. So we scan those old images, and here's a scanned historical image, and here is a modern satellite image with about a 0.6 metre resolution, a very, very high resolution these days. And what we do is georectify that historical image so it's an exact shape of the satellite image, which is usually very accurate depending on, you know, what the metrics were when the image was taken. And that allows us, using GIS systems, to embed geographic information in both images. Again, very, very accurate. And then you can overlay them on top of one another. That becomes a really powerful tool, because if you've got images that go all the way back to the 50s to the present and some in between, you can start extracting some really nice information about how the islands have changed. And this is just a really nice example. So this is in Funafuti again, 2004 to 1984, so a 20-year gap. There's the shoreline. There's the 1984 image, and you can see lots of erosion there, lots of accretion here. We can go back the other way, and it shows up the same thing. The interesting question is that a problem? And I can answer you very, very honestly, it depends if anyone's living there. No one's living there, and there are just thousands of islands all over the Pacific where people don't live because they're too small and they don't really support populations. Where there is this sort of very dynamic shoreline process that's going on, and we don't even notice it. You know, it's just happening all the time. So it really depends. If I speak to a landowner from this area and he's looking at these sorts of dramatic erosion scarps, I've got a really upset landowner. If I'm speaking to a landowner from here, he's happy. He's going out every morning and planting more coconut trees on his new land. Yeah. So you can see that this issue of erosion, it's really based around human perceptions as well, our settlement patterns and the way we utilise the land. Yeah? There's a further dynamic. The British colonised these islands and did what they loved doing, and they started putting lines on maps. They said, this piece of land belongs to you, that piece of land belongs to you, and they set up a government survey department, and they had the FBI lights out. And all of a sudden, boundaries in these islands became immutable because they had been surveyed in. They were not like that previously. If your boundary can't be shifted and you get erosion like this, there's nowhere to go. You're just going to lose your land, your back's against the wall, and then finally you've got no land left. You can go to the Land and Survey Department, they can say, well, the line used to be there, but it's not there anymore. If you go back in time 70, 80 years, there was no such thing as that sort of survey, which meant there could be shifting and flexing and mutation of these sorts of boundaries. And I won't say it was always a happy process. Sometimes that mutation or that shifting would have happened at the end of life, yeah? That's just life in the islands. But the fact is that our use patterns, again, are impacting the way we're impacted by erosion and shoreline change. Okay. So, that's sort of background information. I'm going to take you to some of the examples, Ponape and FSM, of islands that we used to develop that recent paper this year. And in this one we had some fantastic images from 1944 and 2007. We didn't have any in-between images, so we just skipped 60 years, or over 60 years, between one to the other. Now everything we had read told us that we should see a great reduction in land area on these islands because of sea level rise. However, I've just transitioned to the two 1944 images for you, and as you can see, they look very, very similar. We can zero in. There's Pinglap. Today, put a shoreline around it, bring in the 44 image, and we can see some changes around here. Zoom in again. Shoreline. And we go back in time 60 years. What we can see here is that we have accretion or land building there, accretion here, and some erosion on the inside lagoon shore here. Go back the other way. There we are, and that sort of shows the same story. We can look at some of the other islands. There we go. Shoreline. Go back in time. Again, you can see there's been accretion at the end, accretion there. Some erosion here. This is actually an airstrip here. In fact, that's the reason we did this work, because the people who lived there were concerned about erosion associated with that airstrip. As it turns out, the airstrip's made a lot more land for them. Here you go. So the great thing about this is once we've scanned these and they're in the GIS system, we can start extracting very, very accurate metrics about land area over time. We can start tabulating this. And as you collect more and more, as you can see we're doing here, as you collect more and more islands, and this is the total number of islands at the moment, we've got 27 atoll islands, we can then generate decadal rates of change. Now, I don't think there's any accepted formula for this, but I personally hate annual rates of change. I think it's a bit meaningless, particularly where our weather is so impacted by ENSO cycles, which are, you know, 7, 8 years or whatever. So we go with a decadal rate of change. We look at all of these islands, and what we see is if we consider island processes from a total island area perspective, that all of these islands from here to here are either showing a story of stability or some really considerable growth. And the minority, so if we look at these three, I mean, they're all only about 2%. That's really in the bands of variability. I wouldn't feel too confident about those results. And really only there's one which comes down to about a net loss of about 7% in the decadal rates. Okay, so overall, and indeed we need to do many more islands, a whole lot more islands out there that need to be looked at. But if we start collecting these metrics, we actually have an accurate understanding of what these islands are doing. Are they really growing? Or do they show a degree of shoreline resilience in face of climate change stress? The argument that I would say this graph so far shows is that they do show a degree of resilience. Knowing that is incredibly important. If agencies like SOPAC, and there's plenty of others, are going to go to these islands to deploy works based around climate change adaptation, if we go in with a single-minded approach that all shores are erosive, we can't possibly come up with the correct and effective adaptation measures. Okay, we've got to have these sorts of facts so that we're able to implement projects that are going to work for these communities and these environments. Okay, that's the paper. So if you'd like more information around this, that paper is available. I can give you copies from here. Alright. The other reason that this work is done is that it provides us some really startling information around the dynamic between urban and rural environments. So this is Beso in Taro. I can't remember, we've got about 25,000 people living on 1.5 square kilometres of land there. Most of it is about 1 metre above spring high tide, yeah, maybe a little bit more in places. It's all sandy shores, except for where they built these massive concrete structures. Okay, so this is, you know, it's a patch of sand with a huge number of people. It's also the main port of entry, the main settlement, etc., for this country. We did the historical shoreline work in here some years ago because I've received many, many requests around erosion and shoreline vulnerability in this environment. So my thoughts were, well, you really must have some major erosion issues, and I need to sort that out in my own mind before I can try to work with them on the site. And one of the, I guess, benefits of the Second World War is that there was huge amounts of aerial photography generated, and a lot of it's really good resolution. So at this stage, this island had been turned into an aircraft strip, basically, for the Battle of Tararua, which some 5,000 people died at that time. But it shows us a shoreline which was markedly different and markedly smaller to the present shoreline, which says over the years from the 1940s to the present, the actual area of this island has increased quite a lot. Yet we still have all of these coastal erosion issues or being reported to us. There you go. You can see accretion all through here, accretion there. This is obviously all engineering in these places. Accretion. Maybe some bits of erosion there, and that fits because there are actually concrete seawalls being built in that area now. But But overall, we have an island that's grown really remarkably, and we actually had some intermediate photographic layers there. And over the last 60 years, that island's increased by some 30% in size. Yet, we have all of these requests around coastal vulnerability. So what's going on? The fact is that population pressure is making people, the second we get a little bit of accretion, people are living on it. Yeah? They're quite literally living on the edge of the beach berm, okay? The active beach berm. It's such a terrible idea, because any small change in weather or wind patterns, etc., and you can still get erosion, okay? It can still fall away and build up again over time. But if your house is on that bit of land, then you're in trouble. And that's why we get so many requests. It's not that people are making their stories up. They are living in terrible conditions of vulnerability. But it's really about this urban dynamic and the way of planning and it's the preventable management issues around the way people are settling in some of these urban centres now. But remember, you've got all the usual suspects of poverty and critical issues of competition for space, etc. Like this. So further, we can look at a less densely populated area of an island. And this is the deep ocean lagoon in here, and that's the international runway to give you an idea of scale. And in this example, we were asked to look at a community in this area here. Just go back one, right in here. And they had issues of wave incursion, saltwater flooding, etc. And again, real reports, though, they were certainly suffering some hardships. Most of the people that have lived there, these houses have only popped up in the last 20 years ago. 20 years ago, this was bush. Nobody lived there. So again, it's urban pressures pushing people into these marginal areas. And what we looked at was this 1943 image, and we could see immediately that a lot of that area was, in fact, a former channel, an intertidal channel, meaning when the tide was up, water would rush through from the ocean side into the lagoon and vice versa back out again. And there'd been a causeway built across here and reclamation all through here, and now people have all settled inside this channel. And there you go. You can see there's the former channel and there's all the houses where people have settled. Again, it's a terrible place to live. If you live in an intertidal channel, you're living below sea level, in an atoll. So we've got to be able to look at these sorts of products. We've got to make better decisions about planning and keeping people out of harm's way. Rural change. I'll just go through this fairly quick. This is the same island, but this is a small rural village with about 150 people living there. And changes, well, here as well. And overall, only about a 3% increase in land area. A lot of that's because of the lack of engineering, just the fact that people don't disturb the shoreline systems there. And a lot of the island building is natural sort of processes in these rural environments, which is bays like this, which have infilled over time. That's just a normal ongoing process, and we can see that evidence all over. So, let's just review for a second what was thought about atoll shoreline processes and vulnerability. This is a schematic, okay? Recognise that. It's a schematic of an atoll. And here's your atoll here, and we're looking at a section through that atoll, and turning it on its side. Deep ocean drop-off lagoon side here. This flat is the intertidal reef flat here. This is the oceanside beach berm, the low area in the centre of the island, like through here, and then the lagoonside beach berm here, which is usually slightly lower. Now, according to popular thought and even the UNESCO idea of the world, what should happen is as sea level rises, those berms erode back and shrink. The islands become more and more vulnerable to wave incursion, and you see you go from this sort of larger beach berm to a smaller beach berm. You invoke some sort of change in sea level through either ongoing chronic sea level rise or storm event, whatever, and you've got a major problem. The entire island would be inundated under that scenario. Now, as I've shown you, the imagery work that we've done so far doesn't really support this theory. Okay? So, what seems to be occurring at the moment is we do have very low-lying atoll, so it's all the same scenario, most of the people living in this low-lying area. Only shoreline berms are showing a level of resilience. In many cases, the ocean side is stable or receding slightly of the islands we've looked at so far, and the lagoon side, as you can see, is actually... is actually moving lagoonwards. Okay, so we're sort of getting this shift of the island on the atoll platform. But the great news is that it's a story of shoreline berm resilience. In other words, the ability of those shorelines, if they're not disturbed, to protect from waves remains at this time, which is fantastic news. In regards to sea level rise, though, most of the island area remains as vulnerable as it ever did. Because even if the shoreline systems remain resilient and can build and change, this larger part of the land mass is not changing. Okay? It's vertically stable. It will become inundated over time. Okay? So we still have some really big issues in the atolls, but at least some small skerrick of good news around the shoreline systems, and it's important, as I was saying, if we're going to try and manage these shoreline systems, we've got to understand what the processes are. We can't just make up our mind and all erosive and pour lots of concrete. Okay, so saltwater flooding, exactly the scenario that's occurring in Funafuti. It's a low-lying area inside, gets flooded every high tide. It's eventually going to impact Swamp taro gardens, which are reliant on groundwater, fresh groundwater, and drinking water supplies. And I'll just put those up, you can read them. The keys being, there's so little research, and we are doing these people a great disservice by not putting research in and actually finding out what's going on. We've got some idea of sea level, rates of sea level rise, but very little about what the implications of that are. Broad assumptions about any process to do with climate change are unhelpful. We've got to collect the facts to figure out what's going on. As I was saying, knowing that there's potential resilience at this time is important. We can work with that. And the last area which deserves a huge amount of effort is sediment supply. These shores have only remained resilient because there's a continual production of sediment supply. Yet, climate change doesn't just mean sea level rise, it means increased sea surface temperature, so coral bleaching and various other organisms. It also means ocean acidification. Really, the jury's out of it on just exactly how that's going to impact these sorts of reef systems, but definitely the potential is there. We also have the potential for changes in wind and therefore wave climates and their impacts on shoreline systems and transport of sediment. So we need to nut these sorts of questions out. Figure these things out, we then understand vulnerability in these environments. That's why we do the work. There's still a lot of really beautiful cultures and people out in these places, and let's try and serve them well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for a fascinating, challenging, and a provocative talk. Wonderful, really entertaining. We've got time for one or two quick questions. Before we let the hands of the media on
you. I'm just wondering whether in your studies there's been any attempt to look at, maybe through tectonic plate movement or whatever, whether any of the land is actually rising and in other areas it may be falling. And although there may be sea level rise occurring, this may be exacerbating the effect. And then the other thought I had was, how about the growth of coral in those areas where it's still growing? Is that keeping the same rate of growth as the sea levels rising, so providing more protection?
Yeah, I think both great questions, and generally people do ask those exact questions in relation to this work. The sea level array that I showed you in the first talk, all of those stations have an associated continuous GPS station. Yeah? A continuous GPS means it's a special kind of GPS that continually monitors its position in the global grid, if you like. It knows if it shifts up, down, left, right by a fraction of a millimetre. And so for those islands that are associated with that sea level gauge, we've got a really good understanding of any tectonic movement. And at the moment, it's not really a factor. It's so slight that it is neither here nor there in those locations. The other question in regards to the rates of coral growth, no, nobody's doing this work. You know, that's the simple answer. It's such an important question. You can imagine every high tide, we've got our outer reef here and then the beach up here. Every high tide, water moves up, waves break on the reef edge, and the energy moves into the soft shoreline. The best I can do is to say, well, I'm assuming at the moment the coral and the various reef species that grow on that edge are keeping up the sea level rise. Because if the energy window had been opened so much, then I think we'd see some damage against the shorelines. So can only assume. Why aren't we studying it? Well, you know, you tell me. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Is your current hypothesis that the total volume of land above sea level there is diminishing or is staying constant as the land, as the soil shifts, or is there actually land being added, being brought up from the depths and deposited there?
The facts. Many hypotheses. The fact is, of the 27 atoll islands we've measured, okay, the great majority are stable, and then about one third. Let's say that 5% is our sort of cut-off point where we can say it's a significant increase, if you like. So you're looking at what? About 20% of the islands there have increased in size. Yeah, the rest of
the increased in their footprint,
yeah,
in two dimensions.
Yes.
The question was, is this a redistribution of material that's there, or is this through the addition of new material?
The other scenario I showed you, and we need more islands to answer this question properly, is that there's a trend for erosion on the ocean side and building out on the lagoon side. So I think you've got some redistribution, as you're suggesting. I think you've also got the incorporation of new material occurring as well. So where you've got those bays infilling, for example, a lot of that's new material. There's no doubt. Yeah. But again,
any guesses as to where it's coming from?
It's coming from the reef edge. Yeah. We still have very, very healthy reef systems. Remember, an atoll is more resistant to the sort of bleaching events you're seeing in, say, the Great Barrier Reef. Yeah, we've got this big pond of slow-moving shallow water and it just bakes. Yeah. Atoll's not like that. Deep ocean features, very high energy shores, and so they're less vulnerable to the sort of bleaching stress that you'll see in a Great Barrier Reef or lagoon type environment. So I think a lot of our outer rim communities are still productive and are, you know, generating sand and gravel and all the other bits and pieces they should be. Yeah. Have the rates increased? Decreased? You should know.
I think we're going to have to draw it to a close there. Thank you all very much. Arthur and John and I are going for lunch now. Anybody who'd like to carry on having a conversation with Arthur, more than welcome to join us.